And welcome to The Morning Magazine, your Front Range morning news program here on Community Radio KGNU. It's Friday, April 19th. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Hanalei Myers. Coming up on today's Morning Magazine, in advance of a presentation in Boulder later today, we'll hear about the reframing of the perception of women's lives after 50 as a second adulthood versus the unkind negative stigma women over 50 often face. Then we'll have a live conversation with the new Women Work Justice exhibit at the Center for Colorado Women's History in Denver. The exhibit analyzes the intersection of human, civil, and economic rights of women through the stories of women in Colorado history. The annual Mountain Plover Festival will draw hordes of bird watchers to Southeast Colorado this weekend. We'll hear a related interview with a private lands wildlife biologist. He's with Bird Conservancy of the Rockies. At 8:30, we'll go to Connections. KGNU's Roger Wendell is hosting a two-part show. In part one, we'll hear from Jason Treat about his work for National Geographic Magazine's April edition on cities, ideas for a brighter future. In the second half of the hour of On Connections, we'll hear from a Boulder water keeper, his name is Art Hirsch, about E. coli in Boulder Creek watershed. As always, you'll be invited to call in and join that conversation on Connections at 8:30. But first, at 5 minutes past 8 o'clock, it's time for your local headlines. Here's Steve Miller.
Denver's City Auditor's Office has found that the city's fight against homelessness lacks an all-inclusive citywide strategic plan. The Denver Post reports that the audit, released Wednesday, also found that the staff of Denver's Road Home has shrank from 9 people in 2014 to 7 in 2018. Road Home is a coordinating agency for nonprofits that do everything from job placement to housing. Mayor Michael Hancock's administration has agreed to a number of changes, including creating a citywide plan, reassessing the homelessness staff, and creating a new Department of Housing and Homelessness. The report came out on the same day when about 100 people camped near the Denver Rescue Mission were part of a cleanup sweep by the city. Nearly 3,500 people lacked housing in Denver in 2018. The city has directed $51 million in 2019 of its Affordable Housing Fund towards homelessness. The Colorado House of Representatives yesterday approved a bill that would reduce the penalties for drug possession from felony to misdemeanor. Maeve Conran has more.
House Bill 1263 would lower the penalty for possession of Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 drugs from a Level 4 drug felony, punishable by 6 to 12 months in prison, to a Level 1 misdemeanor. That would be punishable by up to 180 days in jail and up to 2 years of probation. It would also create a county court grant program to provide funding for a drug court. The bill only addresses drug possession and not drug distribution offences. Prosecutors would still be able to file felony drug distribution charges if there's evidence of intent to distribute. The bipartisan legislation was approved by the House on a 40-25 vote, and it's part of a slate of criminal justice reform legislation being tackled by state lawmakers this session. Other measures already approved include eliminating cash bail for low-level offences. The measure now heads to the state senate. For KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran.
Tomorrow marks the 20th anniversary of the mass shooting at Columbine High School in Jefferson County. As Lauren Antonoff reports, community members, survivors, and families of those killed will gather for a series of events this weekend.
In 1999, two students took the lives of 13 people and wounded over 20 more before turning their guns on themselves. At that time, the incident was the worst high school shooting in U.S. history. It prompted a national debate on gun control and school safety, as well as an investigation into the gunmen's motivations. Casey Rugsager Johnson was one of the students shot in the library of the school 20 years ago. She is still recovering from her physical injuries, as well as the emotional and mental trauma she experienced. She will be attending Saturday's commemoration and says while this is a large anniversary, every year is difficult.
I think every April 20th is hard, whether it's the 5, 10, or 20-year anniversary. It's always the day in our family that's set aside to celebrate the life that I am privileged to be living still and the family I'm blessed to have, but also remember that some of my classmates weren't given that same opportunity. And to remember that it is a really difficult day for a lot of other people, whether it's 20 years or probably when it's 40 years, it's still going to be really difficult. And there's a level of respect for the journey that everybody involved has been on and how each person in that journey has lived it differently and experienced it differently. And so we usually, as a family, just set it aside as a day of togetherness and a day to celebrate life and remember the people who were lost.
In the years following Columbine, there have been 11 school shootings classified as mass shootings, shootings that involve at least 4 fatalities. A community vigil will take place at the Columbine Memorial in Clement Park this evening at 7:30 p.m. More commemorative events are scheduled for tomorrow. For KGNU, I'm Lauren Antonoff.
On Thursday, the city of Boulder offered Xcel Energy $68.5 million in its attempt to acquire its assets. The Daily Camera reports that the bid continues Boulder's ongoing push to create its own municipal electric utility. The cost estimate, determined by appraisers, includes facilities, 110,000 pieces of equipment, and property. Should negotiations with Xcel fail, the city needs to file condemnation in district court by early June to have the acquisition numbers in time for the 2020 election. The city this year also enlisted Exponential Engineering Company of Fort Collins to do the detailed design of separation between Boulder and Xcel at substation facilities. Boulder has a goal of 100% renewable electricity by 2030, as well as an 80% reduction in the government's emissions by the same year. And in today's weather, sunny with a high in the mid-70s. On Saturday, clouds moving in, but the temperatures should be still in the 70s, mid-70s. And then on Sunday, showers likely, temperatures in the mid-60s. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Society is not always kind to women who are aging. Our youth-obsessed culture means women over 50 can be rendered invisible. But Sue Brightman says this is the time in women's lives that they are emerging into a new productive stage. She calls it adulthood, too. She'll be speaking about the Manifesta of Active Wisdom, emerging themes about a new stage of life at 50 and beyond, later this morning at the monthly Interface presentation in Boulder. She spoke with KGNU's Maeve Conran.
Because the word aging and what it means to age, immediately these pictures pop into our minds that are very much an old narrative. So I prefer to think of it as a new narrative that is being written as we're living it, those of us who are over 50, and I would say well over 50.
Well, that old narrative seems to be that as you age, you become less useful, less attractive, less desirable.
More invisible.
All of that, and more invisible, particularly for older women.
Yes.
As you said, that is the old narrative. But how is that being erased, that old narrative? And what is the new narrative we're seeing?
Yes. So the old narrative is that we become invisible, that we become, yes, less useful, that we don't have as much to contribute anymore. And first of all, that piece is being completely rewritten by women who are in their, let's say, late 50s, 60s, even 70s, who are bursting into whole new arenas of doing things that do indeed contribute to the world and that light them up. And I'm going to say that light us up because I'm one of them. So the part of the new narrative is that we are not on a downward arc of no longer contributing and doing things, but indeed we're with quite a bit of zest discovering and launching very new things in our lives.
Well, give us an example of either your own experience or women. Are we talking about women specifically, or really it's anybody?
I interviewed 100 women And I think that the narrative that's coming out from the 100 women and the principals in the interviews that I did are going to start a dialogue, I hope, for all people, men and women. But it is women who I leaned into just to say, what is it that's happening for us? There are so many examples for every woman who I interviewed, and these were from CEOs of global companies to women who worked in prisons to public school teachers to women who were at home raising their children. The whole gamut. I did that on purpose because I really wanted to hear what are the themes that are separate from any particular economic or racial or religious group. And so examples, the examples abound, but I'm thinking of one particular woman who has spent most of her career teaching management skills to police officers. And she's an expert at it. And she has continued keeping herself very fresh and edgy with what it is that she offers them in terms of ways to supervise and et cetera, leadership skills. And while she was doing this, she came into the age range where her parents and her husband's parents needed caretaking. And so in addition to continuing this work she was doing, she started to caretake her elder parents and her husband's elder parents. She got very interested in how is it that some of the things that she was bringing to the police officers that have to do with how we learn, how we grow, how we stay self-aware, how those might apply to the caretaking that she was doing and to her own life. And the long story short there is from the midst of the work she was doing for all these decades, she sort of birthed a whole new line of work, which is now about intergenerational familying. How do you go about caring for elders, continuing to mentor your own children, and staying active in your own career if that's what you want to do? She found a way to blend all of that together. And in fact, she and her husband have launched a website, and they're doing virtual workshops for other people who find themselves in the same space. So that's one of 100 examples that I came into contact with. And those examples are everywhere.
Now, you mentioned that woman's personal life experience. I mean, those are a set of challenges that so many women of that generation are dealing with, very often caring for elderly parents.
Yes.
And still being caregivers for their children as well. I mean, they're the ultimate sandwich generation. Now, albeit that lady was able to turn that into another avenue for her creative energy and share her experience. But many women are stuck in that because they might have to give up a job to be that caretaker, or it's detrimental to their own mental health and physical health as well. And so given the very many challenges that women in that generation are dealing with, you know, what are some of the ways that they could maybe embrace that, those challenges, so they're not overwhelmed by them?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found with the women that I interviewed was an ability to uncover what it was that they needed for their own, you mentioned mental health, their own physical health, their own continued becoming, so that they weren't completely giving that up and over to anything in their lives that would suck it from them. Now, I don't mean to say that caretaking others sucks all of that from you. Some women have found it very fulfilling, in fact, or have found creative ways to get help caretaking for their elders while they continue in their careers, or have dialed back some of the work that they've been doing in the world to accommodate it. But one of the things that I just so noticed and am deeply respectful about is the wisdom that so many women have come to about what we, and I'm going to say we, what we can and cannot do. What is it that is right for us to do? And what is it that we recognize that we cannot take on because of how it might impact us in a way that we can't continue to contribute in a healthy way for everybody involved? In fact, one of the things that there are 10 themes that came out in the interviews that I did. And one of them I ended up calling Done With That. And it is this place that so many women have come to after living so many experiences and having hardships and having achievements and maybe breaking through glass ceilings or maybe not and learning what that feels like, doing so much for so many decades, that arriving somehow, somewhere around the late 50s, and of course this is different for every woman, but what I found is that women spoke about what they recognize that they're done with. And that can come in many different shapes and sizes. It might be recognizing, as I did, I think I'm becoming done with this work I've been doing in corporations all over the world that has required me to travel and to multitask and all the things I've loved that began to feel like I can recognize, I think I'm coming to closure on it. So sometimes the done with that themes have had to do with what one's career has been. Sometimes it's other things, though. Sometimes it has to do with relationships and not necessarily trying to or being able to be all things to the many people around us. That's not to say that there's a selfishness that takes over, not at all, but it's more that there's this clarity, this strong clarity that comes from wisdom to say, I recognize I'm done with that. And that now makes room for what I want to do and can do that's both good for me, to your point, that doesn't drain me, and at the same time makes a contribution in the way that I want to make the contribution.
Sue Brightman will speak on the Manifesta of Active Wisdom, Emerging Themes About a New Stage of Life at 50 and Beyond, from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Boulder Jewish Community Center as part of the monthly Interface program. Find out more at interfaceboulder.org or suebrightman.com. The time is 8:20 and you're listening to KGNU. Recently, the Center for Colorado Women's History announced the opening of the Women Work Justice exhibit in Denver. The exhibition analyzes the intersection of human, civil, and economic rights of women through the stories of Colorado-based women's groups and movements that pioneered local and national workplace shifts. Here to tell us more about the exhibit and some other timely elements the exhibit is celebrating, we have the director of Center for Colorado Women's History at Byers Evans House, Jillian Allison. Thank you so much for joining us on the phone this morning.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the Women Work Justice exhibit and what visitors will experience when they see it.
The exhibit explores seven stories in Colorado history when women were leading change in the workplace. These stories represent different time periods and different places in Colorado and look at changes in pay equity, in opportunities, and working conditions that women fought for over time. And when visitors come in, they enter into our carriage house. So the setting sort of takes you back to a different time as well. And they'll also have the opportunity to see some antiques and some things that represent some of the stories and sort of ask you the question of who brings some of these things into your lives that you don't always see. So, for example, we have some carnations on the table that represent the work of the carnation workers, which is one of the stories that's told about the National Floral Workers Organization and their origins and struggles.
And tell us about the significance of doing this now. I know this exhibit overlaps with some anniversaries, as well as kind of its connection to some significant activism and justice issues happening in contemporary society. If you could speak to kind of the significance and the timeliness of that intersection there.
Sure. So History Colorado chose to focus on this exhibit right now as we're looking forward to the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which restricted states from preventing citizens from voting on the basis of sex, or gave most women the right to vote in the United States. And as we're looking towards that, we wanted to showcase ways that women could be impacting their communities beyond the polling place. Examples of activism and advocacy in communities that went beyond voting, because voting is so important, but it's just one way in which women have been active in their communities and made huge impacts. So leading up to this major anniversary, we wanted to explore other forms of activism and community participation as well. And then I think the exhibit also is sort of timely and timeless. If you live in Denver, you can see with the teacher strike that happened that these issues related to workplace changes impact us whether we are involved in those workplaces or not, because we're all a part of this larger community. We saw how the impacts affected the whole community, whether you had children in school or were a teacher. And these things happen throughout our communities and impact us in ways that we don't always see. And I think this exhibit is a reminder of how that change has happened for generations, and the ways that groups of people have worked together to make a lot of these changes possible.
And in our last moments here, I know you had mentioned one story there, a story you'd see in the exhibit, but there are any that stand out to tease listeners with here as well, maybe some unexpected kind of stories and examples of advocacy and activism from these grassroots women in the state.
Sure. One of my favorite stories is about Jane Street. She was active in Denver in the 19-teens and organized domestic workers. Domestic workers were really isolated in different people's homes, and that was one of the challenges that they faced. They didn't always know what their conditions were like compared to other people's. We also talk about some laws that were passed to protect people working in industrial laundries and settings that were similar but didn't protect people who were working in domestic settings. And Jane Street employed these really inventive and creative ways to connect these women. She would do things like place want ads, and when women would call to respond to the want ads, she would tell them that she actually didn't have a job, she wanted to interview them about their work conditions. And then she would connect them to one another so that they would be able to respond when they would see someone trying to hire a maid or a cook with unfair working conditions. And so they were able to make significant changes, even though they weren't all in the same workplace and isolated throughout the city. So I thought that was a really creative and interesting issue that I hadn't thought about before.
And can you give us the details on the exhibit, how long it's going to be available for people, and where listeners can find out more?
Sure. The exhibit is going to be at the house through February of 2020. The exhibit itself is free, and if you'd like to learn more about what we offer, you can also take a tour of the house, which is set in some of the time periods that the stories represent, and you can learn more about what we have to offer at historycolorado.org.
And that was Jillian Allison. She is the director of the Center for Colorado Women's History. She was speaking to us about the Women Work Justice exhibit currently on display at History Colorado Center for Colorado Women's History in Denver. Jillian, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And you are listening to KGNU. This weekend, bird watchers will be flocking to Carville in southeast Colorado for the annual Mountain Plover Festival. This region is home to the largest nesting grounds for the birds in the country. Maeve Conran spoke with Ryan Parker, private lands wildlife biologist with Bird Conservancy of the Rockies.
And it begins arriving on the eastern prairies of Colorado in early April. And Carville, Colorado, in eastern Colorado, it just so happens to be some of the best breeding grounds for this bird. So the mountain plover is known as the ghost of the prairie, really because it's so elusive. It's really hard to find. It blends in really well to its surroundings.
Well, give our listeners a sense of what the bird looks like and how it does blend in so much so it deserves that name, Ghost of the Prairie.
Well, the mountain plover, so it's actually a shorebird. And that often confuses people because when you think of shorebirds, you think of birds that you'll see on the beach or along water lines. And the mountain plover, you actually will not find it anywhere near water. You'll find it out sort of in the prairie. So it's, I would say about 5 inches tall. And it is white in color, but it has some brownish, tannish tints on its wings. And then typically has a little black bar on its forehead. What makes it so elusive is that it really blends into cactus and any grasses, because and the sand and the soil. Its body is really, its feathers are really similar in color to its surroundings.
Well, this particular part of Colorado's Eastern Plains, in and around Carvel, I think this is the nation's largest nesting grounds for the mountain plover. Give us a sense of why this particular region is so important for this bird.
Well, this particular region is really important for this bird just because the habitat is prime. Well, mountain plovers really need a short grass, bare ground component for nesting and for foraging for food. They need this because they build their nests on the ground. And they would like sparse vegetation so that they can watch for predators. And so eastern Colorado is typically considered your short grass prairie. So ecologically, that just means that your grass grows in between 3 to 12 inches in height, and it won't get any taller. And prairie dogs are also common on your short grass prairie, and that sort of creates another source of bare ground habitat. And so a mixture of those things really make eastern Colorado a prime habitat for mountain plover.
Ryan Parker, private lands wildlife biologist with Bird Conservancy of the Rockies, speaking about the mountain plover. This weekend, hundreds of people will be gathering in Carvel, Colorado, in the southeast of the state, for the annual Mountain Plover Festival. You can find out more at mountainploverfestival.com. That does it for The Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Hannah Lee Myers.